So the topic for today is the effort factor of awakening. And I think there are times when the word effort does not inspire people. The word effort for some people has almost negative connotations, and it maybe is synonymous with some of the negative connotations for the English word work. You know, sometimes work itself has a negative association. And so let's see what's going on here. So effort to having these negative connotations. And it's rather unfortunate because effort can have a lot of positive associations. Effort can be, there are things we put a tremendous amount of effort in that we actually don't refer to them as effortful, even though there's a lot of energy goes into them. Play is, people who do sports, there can be a tremendous amount of energy goes into the sports, but they don't say they're making effort. I think the word effort in English lends itself to the idea of straining, like you have to make extra effort, I can make, or something. So it's possible that the English word effort shouldn't be used to translate the word virya, V-I-R-A-Y-A. But if I tell you what the literal word meaning of the word is, then maybe that's also not so fortunate in English. Or maybe we're coming into a new era, and the association these words has maybe the pendulum is swinging. But there was a time when I first came into the Vipassana world as a teacher in the 1990s and beginning 2000s that the language of the warrior language of practitioners was kind of taboo. It was seen as being macho and too masculine, and there was a kind of movement towards the feminine, and appropriately so. I'm not complaining at all, but the consequence was certain words, certain concepts and ideas were kind of like you know. And I was so surprised. You know, the men were all avoiding warrior words, and then some of the women teachers started using them, and I said, "Really, we're allowed to?" And so the word virya comes from the word vira, which means hero. And so so sometimes it's translated as heroic effort, but that also has connotations of a lot of work, and you know, so it's really a lot of engagement, intensity, and. But what we're talking about with the factors of awakening is not so much a singular moment of mindfulness as in a little act of mindfulness, a little act of investigation, an act of effort. We're talking about a state of being. And so there's a state of being where there's an engagement, an endeavoring, I like the word engagement, an engagement that arises from deeper inside than a place where it's an uphill battle to make effort, or uphill effort, or it's a whole momentum, it's an engagement, it's a natural movement in a what can feel like a natural direction. And we're talking about this as the factor of awakening, which isn't always present for us. as a state. This is something that practice is moving in that direction. And it becomes richer and richer, it becomes stronger and stronger over time, but maybe it takes years to really feel these qualities come to maturity. So we say, oh, this is a state. I think this is the state maybe they're referring to. And until then, it's appropriate to refer to them more as practices we take on and we engage in. But as factors of awakening, they're more states. And I think it's quite inspiring that we have the capacity for a state of being where the engagement with life, engagement with work, engagement with a practice, is not burdensome work. It's not burdensome effort, like oh no, I have to make effort, you know. But rather is, oh boy, I get to make effort. How great. Like, this is like one of the best things. Who wants to sit and be a couch potato when you can do this kind of effort? This is great to be alive and present and in living this life in this full embodied way. In a heroic effort, heroic engagement. And I think part of the resistance around a word like hero, I don't know all the reasons, there are good reasons to kind of have some challenges with the word. But I've been told that in modern India, that the word veera is used to this day as a word for a soldier. An Indian soldier is a veera. I don't know if it comes from the idea of a hero or kind of a warrior or something like that. But it isn't a warrior or a hero that's conquering and vanquishing other people. We're heroic in the face of our own attachments. We're heroic in the face of our own... there's a word that I don't use very much, which is a very common word in Theravada Buddhism, the word defilements. I think the word defilements more literally means that which torments. Defilement, the word defilement kind of implies that something is... it's just like a value judgment. It's really bad. It's like a sin or something. Whereas the word torment is more how it's actually experienced. Some things are afflictive. And so there are these tormenting states it's heroic to face these tormenting ways that we can be, that we're kind of causing our own suffering. We're consumed with greed or lust, consumed with hostility, resentment, hatred, consumed with just confusion and doubt and not knowing what to do, maybe enveloped by fear, maybe burning with conceit. So there's all these powerful things that can be can really torment people, and I don't know if some of you have been tormented by your own, you know, inner life. There are people who are tormented by it, but we have such a strong tendency to look outside of us for the fault, the blame, the cause. And so it's kind of like the world is doing something. Those people are doing it. And certainly people hurt each other. But there's a way in which we're sometimes wearing blinders and we're only looking outside of ourselves. In the Dharma, for the purpose of Dharma practice, if what you want to do is Dharma practice... And that's a big if. If that's what you want to do, then the directionality of where we look is into our own hearts, into our own minds, and how what happens here with us. What are we contributing to this? Not to be blind to what happens in the world and the responsibilities for other people for some of our challenges, but maybe that's for another time. Not from when we're sitting on the cushion, not when we're doing the practice on retreat. This is a time to turn inward and really see what's happening here. And this factor of awakening that Inez talked about so well last night, yesterday, it's actually two words that we translated as sometimes translated as investigation. The two words are Dhamma and Vichaya. And Vichaya means more like to separate or distinguish. And Dhamma is like Dharma. And I evoke it now because there's this part of the liturgy of our tradition refers to the Dhamma as visible and immediate, and ehipasiko is the Pali expression. It's usually translated as come and see. The Dhamma is that which is beckoning you, as come here, take a look, come here. And after there was about 1,000 years of development of Buddhist thought in India and in China, somewhere around the 6th century, there was a very famous Chinese Buddhist teacher, very erudite. He studied all the 1,000 years of texts and translated to Chinese and created a kind of synthesis of this total, it was an amazing synthesis of 1,000 years of Buddhist thought. And in the middle of that is big book about this synthesis, he has this one sentence that kind of is the essence or the heart of what he discovered in years of study of Buddhism. And that one sentence is, awakening beckons you within everything. Awakening beckons you within everything. It's kind of like everything you touch and see and feel and smell is saying, hey you, come here, be awake, be free. And so this ehipasiko, this come and see for yourself. So when we turn the attention inwards in practice, sooner or later, and sometimes it's later, I think we'll feel that beckoning, that call. Come here, look more deeply. Here's where the work is. Here's where it feels good to make the effort. Here's the Dharma field for playing in. Here is where something is showing itself to us that shows us the way forward, shows us what's worthwhile to do, what's worthwhile to put our life energy into, what's worthwhile to where to direct our attention and what choices to make. And so it's not just simply being mindful, just sitting and quietly being mindful and recognizing what's happening. But one of the functions of mindfulness is to let us be quiet and still enough and attentive enough and non-reactive enough to be able to sense and feel and perceive and listen deeply so that we can start seeing how the path goes away from what torments us to what enhances us, that brings us great happiness. And to see that distinction of that path, is, as Inez said, and I think I said this morning as well, is one of the purposes of this thing we call investigation. Sometimes this distinguishing of the dharmas. We distinguish between those things that are afflictive, that we do, that have the ouch, and those things that go in the other direction, to peace, to freedom, to some wonderful dharmic, this is good, this is well-being, this is happiness, that we can only find if we are deeply, deeply sensitive and present for ourselves, that the mindfulness practice is kind of slowly cultivating and developing. The Dharma book for each of us to read, the real Dharma book, is the book you find in your own heart, to find within. Because you have to, we want to start learning to read what's here. And it's not like a difficult book in a foreign language. It's actually in your language. And it's how you can feel or sense or see or hear the difference between clinging, tightening up, constricting around anything at all, around your identity, your conceit, around your desires, around your aversions, around your fears. You can feel how that is. You can feel the ouch of that. You can feel how even something mild like being lost in a pleasant fantasy, even though it's a pleasant fantasy, there's something not quite right about that. There is an alienation. There is a kind of flatness, two-dimensionality. It's kind of, after a while, with a lot of fantasy, it can be really tiring and old. And there is something afflictive in being caught in even in pleasant fantasies. And after a while, to really sense that and feel that, and to see, to smell, or to sense that there is another way. There is a possibility of not being contracted, not being clinging, not holding on, not being closed, not being alienated. And so to see that distinction, then you probably will discover that you're being beckoned, you're being called over here. Come in the direction of freedom. Come in the direction of letting go. Come in the direction of being really connected and have a vitality and a life here. And so to start knowing this is the direction to go, this is where to engage in. So for something as simple as you're off in a pleasant fantasy, and you know, maybe after doing it a long time, you're no longer so seduced by the pleasantness of it, but you feel the alienation of it, the disconnect that it provides. And then you remember that when you're mindful, when you have really aware of your experience, that feels so much better. Oddly enough, you might even feel that it actually feels more right, more satisfying to be fully aware of something that's unpleasant than it is to be unaware in pleasant fantasy. I think to be fully aware of something unpleasant, there is an aliveness, there's a connectedness, there's like a sense of being present for what's true. And a sense of being, yes, this is a, now I'm on the path. This is the path forward to find my way with this. That's absent if we're lost in fantasy. So then, what are you going to do? If you see that fork in the road, fantasy or practicing awareness, being mindful. then you might ask, well, isn't there a third option? What if I just make a better fantasy? Maybe if I, you know, I'm a smart person, and I'll just kind of think up a fantasy that's a little bit more sensual in nature and uses more my sense doors, and just I make it richer, and I just fantasize better. If you do that, you are making effort. That's the effort factor. But you're making effort for something which is not very useful. But the pull into that desires, pull into aversion is so strong that sometimes it takes heroic effort to step away from it and choose another path. Sometimes our families, our society, our friends conspire to encourage us to stay attached, stay holding on to something, because that's what everyone else is doing. I met a couple once who said that, I guess their relationship, their marriage fell apart, but it was kind of like that, the medium of conversation about them, between them, that sustained them for years, was talking about their next vacation, or the next thing they were going to buy, or the next thing they were going to fix in the house. It was always this, the promise of what was coming, that kind of was the glue for the, who they were. And when one of the spouses felt like he didn't want to live that way, it created a real dissonance in the relationship, because the medium of communication was beginning to falter. Or I felt at some point that I had to, with some friends I was living with, that it was time for me to give up some of the kind of the fictitious guilt that I was acting under, the kind of the sense of self that I thought I had to be a good person. And I didn't feel like I could do it anymore once I started meditating regularly. And I could see that when I came to hang out with my friends in this new way that I wanted to be, that felt much more, had much more integrity, that it created dissonance in the relationship. They wanted the old Gil who was attached to things to be there. And so I was new to practice, young in my life. And so I gave up the practice for about 6 months because I didn't want to lose my friends. And then when I no longer was living with them, then I started up again and never looked back. But so sometimes it takes a heroic effort to break free from some of the ways we're trapped and caught in our life. And sometimes it's heroic, not so much because the nature of the effort from moment to moment. What's heroic is that we do the simple effort, simple engagement, but we make it a priority, so that it's more important than Netflix. It's more important it becomes a real priority. We choose to make our life based in the Dharma, and that's not an easy thing to do. But if you feel that calling, that beckoning, liberation beckons you within everything. If you feel the possibility of freedom and see the rightness and the goodness of it, of awakening, then maybe it's well worth the kind of heroic effort to engage in what you're doing. So the classic discussion about what is right effort, some translators call it right endeavor. I don't know if that word works better for some of us than effort. So it's the endeavor. There's four forms of endeavoring, four things to endeavor in, to be engaged in. And to start to make it really simple, it's divided into two different things. One is to avoid doing the ouch, things that do ouch. Engage in those things that lead to a genuine, useful, that's good. The language of the tradition is to avoid what is unskillful, unhelpful, unwholesome, and engage in what is skillful, helpful. So right effort is to do what is, what you do is to avoid some things, or if you avoid them if you haven't done them yet, but if you're doing them, let them go. And the skillful ones, if you're not just yet doing the skillful ones, begin. And if you're doing them, keep doing them. That's the classic Buddhist definition of right effort and the fulfillment of this effort factor of awakening. And to be able to follow that, you have to have some inner sense of what is skillful and what is not. You have to have some sense of feeling, noticing. So for example, if you practice mindfulness and you start feeling that your mindfulness is straining and contracted and pushing, like trying, you say, well, the mindfulness, isn't that supposed to be wholesome and skillful to be mindful? Yes, but the contraction, the straining, that's not wholesome. So then you say, well, how then can I do the mindfulness in a wholesome way, in a skillful way? How can I do it without a strain, without a contraction, without pushing? And then we would look for that and find a way to be more at ease and relaxed. Making heroic effort at having relaxed mindfulness. Is that a juxtaposition of words that shouldn't be put together in the same sentence? Heroic effort at being relaxed. If that's the goal, you can't really strain in the heroic effort, because then you're not going to relax. So how do you do this heroic effort in a way that doesn't contract you or strain you? So looking and finding our way. And then if you haven't engaged in what's skillful, please do. If you haven't been mindful for a while, please start it. If you don't kind of look more carefully to really see clearly what's here, you're mindful, but don't look at it carefully. Look at it carefully. That's the investigation part. And maybe if you're really quiet and sensitive and really sense, you'll start seeing more the divide between a path to what's afflictive and a path to what's beneficial. And then what makes the effort effortless? So what makes the effort a delight to do? That you, of course you want to do that. Why not? I think that's requires also some care and attention, reflection about, do we only think of effort as being a strain, as being hard, challenging? Or what reference point might we have for an engagement at making choice and doing and moving in some direction that feels just easeful, a delight, a joy? Of course that's what I'm going to do. It's actually easier to do that than to not do it. So what I mean by this is that, if I let my thoughts wander freely, there is a kind of ease to that, and there is kind of, it's kind of effortless in a certain kind of way to let my thoughts wander around, and then to let go of my thoughts or redirect my thoughts or do something takes a little bit of effort. And some people who are new to mindfulness will find that effort exhausting to kind of begin countering the momentum of thinking. Because it turns out that our thinking is not so effortless after all. It just seems that way. Or it's effortless to give into it. And so we just kind of give into and follow along, and, you know, their thinking leads the way, and we just merely go along and think away freely. But it turns out that the effort to be present, to be mindful, to be concentrated, brings you to a place that has less effort, less work, less energy needed than what's needed to be thinking. So it's kind of like if what you want is to be, if you don't want to make a lot of effort, then make the provisional effort to get concentrated. And you'll, after a while, you'll notice, hey, the effort to move in the skillful direction is actually the direction of more ease, more peace, more simplicity, more engagement that feels satisfying, that feels nourishing. And that's one of the characteristics of these seven factors of awakening, is each of them is understood to be nourishing. So how do we make effort so it's nourishing for us? That's the potential for how we engage in the practice. And so then what I keep saying is that if we're able to listen deeply, at some point we become attuned, really sensitive to what is unskillful and what is skillful, where there's a work of contracting, resisting, holding on for dear life, and where there's a much less work, the easeful work of moving to open, to relax. A fist held for a long time is always effortful to keep it as a fist. But to know that the hand can open and be at ease and relaxed not only allows you to have the ease in your hand and for your hand to relax and to recover, but it also makes the hand a wonderful instrument that can do a lot more things when they're open than when it's kept chronically in a fist. So this feeling of movement towards this ease and openness, freedom, leads to more and more sensitive instrument in the heart and the mind for walking this path of practice, moving on and on and on. So the heroic effort of a retreat has a lot to do with the continuity of effort, the continuity of engagement, continuity of being mindful. And so the art of this is to discover both how to be as continuous as is available to you and how to do it in a way that's nourishing for you. If you make continuous effort as a duty and you strain and you push, maybe that doesn't really work for you. But if you make half-hearted effort, you can't really overcome some of your afflictive tendencies. So how do you make heroic effort? In a way that is inspiring, that's easy. And oddly enough, sometimes the easy way, it takes a lot of work to get there. Because of the resistance, because of the wind drag of our attachments and all that kind of stuff. So, it takes some effort to find it. But then the goodness of that effort, to know that you're on a good path, to know that this is moving towards health, this is moving towards truth, this is moving towards integration and being really present with oneself and really here in this life, can make it inspiring to do it even when the heroic effort requires much of us. Oh, at least I know I'm doing something, I'm on the right path. If I wasn't on this path, you know, actually, if I'm honest about it, it's true that I'm a little bit leaning in that other path that's more unskillful. You know, a little bit, you know, I'd probably watch more Netflix than it's probably good for me. Or probably I'd spend more time complaining that's good for me. Or probably I'd spend more time, I don't know. But to make this heroic effort. And then it's more like play. It's more like delight to do this work. It's effortless effort, kind of. So, as I said at the beginning, the effort or the engagement factor of awakening is more a state of being than an act, a particular act that we do. And so with time, this feeling of momentum, of vitality, of aliveness to really move in this direction of engaging in the skillful, engaging in the practice, seems to kind of just flow through us, move through us. There's an enthusiasm, there's energy for it. There is, not because we're pumping ourselves up with caffeine, but because there's this release of a natural aliveness that now is channeled into what is good. What torments us, the attachments, the clinging, the fears, the resistance, dampens the natural vitality. Tension and stress dampens the natural vitality. And so as we practice, and I'm not saying it will happen in this retreat, but as we practice and freeing, and we free ourselves of all these things that dampen us, this vitality comes. And it doesn't come, you know, forever. And you, sometimes on a retreat, there'll be one period through the day where this vitality of practice really is clear, really there, and then it wanes. Because everything has a lifetime and comes and goes, and then it comes and goes again. But to let this vitality, and one of the things that helps with this vitality, this aliveness, is to recognize it. It's actually more often here than you realize. Because you're distracted, you're involved in all kinds of important preoccupations. Vitality beckons you here. Vitality beckons you to freedom. What is it? This here. And then the final thing I'd like to say about the kind of effort engagement we make in the practice. The quality of our effort, the quality of our engagement on a retreat will go up and down in the course of the retreat, of the day. And some people are more morning people and they feel more engaged in the morning. Some people are more evening people and that's when they feel more nicely engaged. And some people afternoon people, all kinds of ways that this works. But it's natural that, I think it's pretty natural, there are times during the day in a retreat where we're tired, we're maybe hungry, we've been practicing well, and it's kind of the momentum kind of went out. And so the quality of the effort is not that high the way it was earlier. So that's completely normal. And you don't have to berate yourself or feel bad about that pattern. And you don't have to compare yourself to earlier, it was better and now it's worse. But as a practitioner, the job of a practitioner is to offer the practice, offer the best effort that's available at that time. And so if the best effort at 8 o'clock in the evening doesn't look that hot compared to 8 o'clock in the morning, you're not expected at 8 p.m. to have hot, shining, heroic effort. Some dramatic, inspiring way. What you're expected is just do the best you can. That's all. And so one of the little secrets about retreat practice is the momentum of the practice builds with the sincerity, your sincerity, of offering to the practice the best effort that's available at any given time. Don't compare yourself to other people. Don't compare yourself to yourself at other times. Just, okay, this is what I have. I'll keep offering it. I'll keep offering it. And then something begins to develop. It's almost like sincerely offering what you have, the best you have. That's the key. That's what kind of lights the fire. Or that's what builds momentum. Not necessarily having really strong effort all the time. So, I hope I haven't exhausted you just listening to a talk on effort. I hope this isn't just like one big 45 minutes of bad news. You thought that Vipassana Buddhism was all about just kind of accepting everything as you are and just be able to live in enlightened retirement where you no longer have to make any effort. We have here the statue here behind me of the Buddha. I think, the uprightness and straight back and clarity and strength of that posture, that's at least the way it's represented by the artist. The Buddha, his enlightened retirement is not couch surfing, laying on the beach. There's actually a better energy, better aliveness, better relaxation in sitting upright and being present and here. So that's what he is. He's been that way for a few thousand years. So anyway, I hope that this has inspired you a little bit to engage in the practice of the retreat and offer your effort. Partly remember that this, as a factor of awakening, the effort factor builds from the momentum of mindfulness, the momentum of the clarity that investigation represents, clear seeing. And because it becomes more and more obvious where the effort should be, and you become your own teacher this way. And so becoming your own teacher makes it clear where awakening beckons you, where the truth calls you, where freedom calls you. Here's the direction, here it is. And may you choose that path, may you choose that direction. And please, don't be afraid of being heroic. I think we could use a lot more heroes. And I think that from the 1990s to now, our culture is beginning to accept the need for heroes. There was a billboard I saw today. Imagine a huge billboard about heroes. It said, some heroes don't wear capes. So, May you be a hero. Thank you.